Our next case is United States v. Chavez-Morales, number 17-2124. Counsel?
Your Honor, counsel, my name is John Butcher. I'm an assistant federal public defender. I represent Mr. Chavez-Morales. We're requesting that this court reverse the sentence and remand this back to the district court for a new sentencing. We do not believe the sentencing court reasonably considered the mitigating factors in this case in coming to its conclusion for an upward departure. We would note that initially Mr. Chavez-Morales reentered the United States. He was offered the fast-track plea agreement, which he accepted. He pled guilty to the fast-track. He was looking at a 9 to 15-month range. The district court rejected that, which was within the court's right to do so. Initially, there's some indication that the court would accept a guideline sentence. Ultimately, Mr. Chavez-Morales pled guilty to reentry with no plea agreement. His sentencing range was 21 to 27 months. The court indicated at that point that it intended to go upward, and it departed up one-third of the top end of the range to a sentence of 36 months. We believe that the court did not reasonably consider Mr. Chavez-Morales' sentencing arguments as required, and thus the sentence must be remanded and sent back to the district court for new sentencing. We also believe the court erred under plain error by imposing the maximum term of supervised release in violation of 5D1.1 of the guidelines and the application notes, as well as the section 3853 of the statutes. Your Honors, in this case, Mr. Chavez, the court focused on the fact that this was Mr. Chavez-Morales' fifth reentry, that the court found and departed upward because it found an objective disrespect to the laws of the United States. When the trial counsel objected to that and pointed out that Mr. Chavez-Morales did not, in fact, have a disrespect for the laws of the United States, but was driven by extreme economic motivation, the court accepted that and agreed that there was no substantive disrespect for the law, but still found objectively that there was a disrespect for the law, and saying enough is enough, then departed upward and imposed a sentence of 36 months, 9 months above the top end of the guideline. We believe that this reflects that the court did not meaningfully consider the vast amount of mitigation argument in this case. First of all, the nature of the upward departure justification being an objective disrespect for the law is really a fiction. It doesn't really go to a 3553A factor. There's some sort of speculation what that is, but when the court acknowledged that subjectively he did not have disrespect for law, that but still found it that because of this, and this is why I'm going to do this, thus we think that is the error, that he did not meaningfully consider the overwhelming mitigation, and more importantly, that Mr. Chavez-Morales did not have a disrespect for the law of the United States. He was driven by desperation or duress, and that is why he reentered the United States. And thus, once again, is we do not challenge the court rejecting the...
Well, counsel, is it really an either-or situation? I mean, I understand that the argument was that he was coming back to help his family, that there was financial motive, but when you enter illegally five times, can't you have a motive to help your family but also disrespect the law?
Well, you're...
I mean, there doesn't have to be one single reason or one single motive, or why can't those two coexist?
Well, I don't think there's any indication that he reentered the United States to thumb his nose at the United States, that somehow he's making some kind of political statement by reentering the country, that the motivation was solely for economic...
But if someone commits the same crime five times over, how is that not disrespect for law?
Well, because people can commit crimes for a variety of reasons, and that's what 3553A acknowledges.
Yeah, but on each occasion, he was told not to do it again. I mean, this is the law. You violated it. Don't do it again. And then he does it again. And it happens over and over and over.
Well, once again, Your Honor, I'm not justifying him coming back to the United States.
I'm not talking about justifying. I'm just talking about whether it was permissible for this court to determine that there was at least a disrespect for law reason for the sentence here.
Well, I don't think there is a disrespect. I don't think there is a subjective disrespect for the law, and I'm not sure there's an objective disrespect for the law that it goes to a 35th grade sentencing factor. What our concern is this is not a situation where the judge gave the top end of the guideline. We're not arguing that the judge was wrong in rejecting the fast track. So once 3553C comes into play, that is what changes this analysis, Your Honor. And that's what I think it makes the court have to more articulate and look at the mitigation reasons offered by the defense. Sort of like this is the same judge that was in Lente. And once again, this is something the court could have done. I think the court would be right if the judge had imposed a 27-month sentence and was in the guidelines, and that would be sufficient, and his comments, I think, would be unassailable.
Well, the court didn't ignore the financial motive to return. I counted at least two places where, in the transcript, where the court addresses specifically the financial motive and talked about comparing how he could meet this motive by staying in Mexico versus coming here. So this was considered, and you're not suggesting that the court didn't even consider the economic reason for coming back.
Well, Your Honor, all I can go in, and I was not the counsel at sentencing, is what the record reflects, what the court ultimately said it was reasons were to do an upward departure. Yes, there was a banner between the court and counsel about how much he made when he was in jail, but at the end, the court just said, you know, he said enough is enough. This is his fifth reentry, and that I find there's an objective disrespect for the laws of the United States. In that statement, I think that shows that there was not a reasonable weighing of mitigation factors, because the court just said, basically, you came in five times, that's all I need to know, enough's enough, and I'm departing upward.
Well, but aren't you making, you're not making a substantive reasonableness argument.
That's correct. That was not raised in the brief.
So we really can't, I mean, he considered the financial motive and weighed it, however the court weighed it, can we really second-guess that decision?
We're not asking this court to second-guess the decision. We're asking it for a remand back to the district court. So, you know, we're saying that we're asking for a remand, the court consider our mitigation as the court, I believe, did in Lente with this same judge. Your Honor, we also believe, I did want to get into the second part as well, about we think the supervised release was also imposed in plain error. In this case, Your Honor, the court did not follow the guideline and once again departed from the guideline and imposed the maximum term of supervised release. I would briefly request the court to consider recommending that the circuit re-review its position in Steele, because I think this case shows that the need for a process that after a court pronounces a sentence, the court asks for any comment on the sentence. We believe that given the court, how the sentencing came up, there was not really an opportunity for defense counsel to really comment on the imposition of the 36 months. Once again, we acknowledge under the current precedent of under Steele that we have to argue plain error, but we think the court should consider the approach of the 6th and the 11th Circuit and perhaps reconsider what it will require of the sentencing court, because I think in this case some of the issues could have been cleared up if the sentencing judge had said, counsel, do you have any comment upon the sentence, and had an opportunity, made a clear opportunity for the counsel to comment.
Let me, in this case, I'm not even sure that would help you, because here didn't defense counsel invite the court to impose a condition of supervised release?
Yeah, not ultimately how it was imposed, but yes, the court is correct. Your Honor is correct that in trying to sell the lesser sentence, and I believe trying to sell the fast track, he did say, well, you could give this lesser sentence and supervised release. But once the court, and that's, you know, once the court rejected that, and not only did not give a guideline sentence, but gave an upward departure, I think at that point it changes that. And if you look at what 5D1.1 talks about, and also what 3853 talks about, we don't know the reason why the court imposed the supervised release in this case, and much less to give the maximum term of it. In this particular case, if it's what the government suspects, first of all, under Zhanghai, we cannot assume that the reasons for the sentence are the reasons for the imposition of the supervised release. But in this particular case, this sort of punishment aspect the court focused on for the imposition of the upper end of the guidelines is not a factor the court can use under 3853 to impose supervised release. That 3553A2 is specifically not incorporated in 3853 and the reasons to look at and how a trial court should impose a supervised release.
But in the note to section 5D1.1, it makes it pretty clear that the court can consider using supervised release as an additional deterrent in a case, even in a case where someone's going to be deported after they serve their sentence.
Your Honor, that is an incomplete quote of the comment. It says deterrent and protect for protection. In the line before that, it makes it clear that it's deterrent and protection for the public. So I think, and if you look at the reason for amendment, the commission talks about you know, that 50% of the, if you look at the reason for amendment for why they changed that, I think it makes it clear that it has to be something more than just deterrence, because in the reason for amendment, as well as in the guideline itself and the application, says the new case is sufficient punishment for the reentry. So in case unless there's a reason for deterrent and protection that's more individualized, for example, there was an issue of this person coming back and harassing somebody, or this issue of this person coming back to sell drugs, or that's what I think the commission is talking about, because it's not an or, it's not a comma, it's deterrent and protect, and in the line before, deterrent and protect for the public. But
counsel,
once again,
counsel, on the supervised release issue, under plain error review, why is it probable the result would be any different in this case? How do you satisfy step three of plain error review?
Your Honor, in this particular case, because of what the guideline talks about, and in this case, especially if this court affirms the 36 months upward departure, that the commission's whole point is proved. The commission says you don't have to impose this as a secondary hammer because the new offense, when you get the new charge, you can punish them enough. And if the court, like the court did in this case, if the court affirms his sentence. Your Honor, I have a little less than 2 minutes, if I may reserve
Thank
it.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Mishlevietz, and I represent the United States in this matter. As to the defendant's first argument about the upward departure, the defendant has waived that argument by failing to plead plain error in his opening brief when it is an unpreserved objection at the district court. The United States notes that the court could exercise its discretion to review that decision, but should not.
Well, but it was argued in the reply brief.
What's that?
Plain error was argued in the reply brief.
Yes, sir, but while that gives the court the discretion to review it, the United States argues that the court should not because
how do you square that with our decision in United States versus Zander, where we said that arguing plain error in the reply brief would be sufficient?
My reading, which could be inferior to the court's, is that it is sufficient to allow the court to review it should the court so choose, but does not mandate the court.
Well, that would be true if there was no argument at all. It's a question of whether there's enough there to entitle the appellant to plain air review. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought we said in Zander that making the argument in the reply brief would be enough.
If Zander says that the defendant is entitled to plain error review upon arguing it in the reply, I don't ask the court to change that. But not raising it in the opening brief was a strategic decision. If I had not noticed and raised in the response brief the plain error analysis, we would be put in a position where we would have to either ask for permission to surreply to add that argument, or the defendant would be standing here today, or Mr. Chavez would be standing here today on a more favorable standard of review. And the United States asked the court to discourage that sort of strategic behavior.
Well, if we get to the issue, I understand your argument, but if we get to the issue, could you address the argument about the district court accepting that Mr. Chavez had no subjective disrespect for the law? How do you address that issue?
We need not show that the defendant, like some mustache-twirling villain, was committing the crime on purpose to show his contempt personally for the laws of the United States. I have had cases where defendants have committed a crime on purpose to draw attention to an issue. This is not that crime. But the United States position, both at sentencing and here, was that 3553A demands a sentence that is sufficient to deter. And if a person commits the same crime over and over again, they demonstrate that the prior sentences they got for that same crime of conviction have failed to deter. Either A, because they have some inability to understand choices and consequences, or B, because their motivation to return to America is so great that whatever sentence of imprisonment was imposed before simply was unable to overcome their motivation to come to the United States to try to earn more money. When deterrence is insufficient to deter, it is merely a cost. And Mr. Chavez Morales demonstrated through the conduct in his life up until this crime that all of the costs that were imposed by all of the prior district courts, one of them being the same judge in one of his earlier felony reentries, was insufficient to deter and was considered by the defendant to be merely a cost of his attempts to earn money in the United States. So when the district court says that he has objectively demonstrated a disrespect for the United States, that disrespect is not imagined, as the as Mr. Chavez says on page 41 of his brief, but demonstrated. That Mr. Chavez demonstrates his insufficient respect for the United States every time he breaks its laws, for whatever reason he breaks its laws, whatever his motivation.
Counsel, under your argument, if any person has made a second entry, which obviously means they know what their law is, doesn't that mean that a fortiori all second re-entries are subject to a finding that is not sufficient to deter? And if not, where is the standard that you draw the line on whether it's one, two, three, or four?
My answer, Your Honor, is that all subsequent felony reentries are proof that the sentence for the prior felony reentries was sufficient,
well, but
insufficient
in terms
to
of
deter.
Disrespect for the law, what triggers the holding of disrespect for the law when the court has found no subjective disrespect for the law?
When a court finds that a defendant was properly advised of the penalties for committing any given offense, which always happens when there is no error in a sentencing on a prior event, whether it's for felony reentry of an illegal alien or any crime, when a district court sees that a person has been sentenced in a federal court for doing any given thing and then does that thing again, that is proof that the penalty they received the prior time was insufficient to deter their subsequent conduct, and indeed that whatever respect they had for the law, subjectively or otherwise, was insufficient to guide their conduct.
So, but your position at bottom is that a second re-entry, a fortiori, permits the trial court to find that the if second entry constitutes a disrespect for the law.
Yes, sir. This is a fifth re-entry, but yes.
Well, I'm asking where the line is drawn, and apparently you draw the line at any re-entry after a previous conviction constitutes disrespect for the law.
Any re-entry without permission in violation of 1326 after a prior sentencing for that same crime. So I wouldn't analyze it the same if it was an entry without inspection, misdemeanor, deportation, and then a first felony reentry. But when someone is sentenced by a federal judge for felony reentry and then is deported again and doesn't seek permission and comes back to the United States again voluntarily, yes, that demonstrates a disrespect for the law objectively. the next thing I want to say about argument one, the meaningfully considered defense proposal, is that, quote, meaningfully considered isn't the standard in the Tenth Circuit. The standard that we get from the Supreme Court is consideration. We get that in Rita against the United States. Lenti from the Tenth Circuit tells us the court must address. And Cerno from the Tenth Circuit says the court must consider. If we at this circuit adopt meaningfully consider, what we are doing is inviting every subjective complaint about a failure to persuade the district court to be brought up to this court as a procedural error rather than a substantive error. I think the most important sentence in the appellant's brief on that point comes on page 23, and the sentence is, quote, the district court was unconvinced, end quote. The actual complaint that Mr. Chavez has is not that the economic motive for committing the crime wasn't brought up to the district court. It was. It wasn't that the district court didn't address it. The district court did. One time in a Socratic dialogue with counsel, and one time in explaining that the defendant actually wasn't going to make more money in the United States because he got caught every time, and in jail he makes less money than he makes in Mexico. The, quote, meaningfully considered argument is really just a complaint that the district court wasn't convinced. I respectfully request this court, if it does reach the merits on argument one, find that it continues not to adopt that standard, because that standard would only invite an avalanche of procedural or substantive complaints masquerading as procedural complaints. Moving on to argument two, the supervised release. There, plain error was briefed, and so we do have plain error review. The United States takes the position that the district court did not err in the first place.
And what about in failing to address the guideline, 5D1.1C? Wasn't it error not to address it?
So the court adopted the findings of the PSR, and the findings of the PSR included, and we're looking at volume 2, pages 12 to 13, that the PSR said specifically, normally supervised release is not imposed. As Judge McHugh noted, that note goes on to explain there could be times when it should be imposed. And so what I do is look to volume 3, page 16, at the paragraph in which Chief Judge Johnson imposed the term of supervised release. And that paragraph reads, after service of the sentence, the defendant is placed on supervised release for a term of 3 years. The term is unsupervised with mandatory and standard conditions and the following special condition. The defendant shall not illegally reenter the United States. And I hope this time around, the defendant will listen to what I'm telling him and listen to what his lawyer told him. You will never, ever be authorized to come to the United States legally. So unless you want essentially to spend the rest of your life sitting in a U.S. prison cell, I strongly recommend that after you serve this sentence and you're deported, you never return to the United States, end quote. Clearly, that paragraph reveals the district court's motive to deter. And while it is true that the new sentence on a potential new reentry case could also serve as punishment, we don't know if Mr. Chavez-Morales sometime in the future will return to the United States through Arizona or through Texas, and several of which he's done already.
Well, I still need you to connect the dots for me.
Sure.
How does that satisfy the court's obligation to address the guideline? Is that, are you just saying in so many words it did? Or go ahead.
If the court is required to say words such as, and I am imposing supervised release because, you can see that there's no such sentence in the record. And if the court is required to say, and I find under this note to the guideline that the specific deterrence justifying supervised release is required because,
the court required to recognize that there is this guideline, but in spite of the general message of the guideline, the court has decided to impose supervised release, and here are the reasons why. Why isn't a court required to get that on the record to ensure, for purposes including appellate review, that the guideline was considered?
We take the position that by adopting the PSR, which explicitly mentions that guideline, that he did, by reference, explicitly mention the guideline. But I agree he did not say sentences during that are revealed in the transcript.
Well, we know he didn't say that, but I think what I'm hearing from you is that's not, your position is that's not error.
Our position is that he...
Well, that's the issue, isn't it? Was there procedural error or not? Is that what we're supposed to decide?
That's prongs one and two, sir. Yes. Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, then help us with making that decision by answering that question.
Yes, sir. We take the position that by explaining his explicit deterrent motive to impose that term of supervised release, that he has invoked the deterrent permission to invoke the supervised release that Judge McHugh mentioned being in the note, and that by incorporating the PSR and adopting the PSR that contains that guideline note, that he has given the defendant fair notice that he is aware of that guideline and how it applies.
Okay.
If we were to disagree with you, can you address whether his substantial rights were affected?
Yes, and as I noted in the brief, they are not. There is nothing that the defendant, that Mr. Chavez-Morales would be allowed to do without the term of supervised release that he is now not allowed to do. The district court could have imposed a term of supervised release that commanded that he never reenters to the United States, whether or not he gets permission. The district court could have, as in Zanghi, imposed a term of home confinement that is more restrictive than the absence of that term, but that's not what happened here. The district court imposed the standard conditions of supervised release in an unsupervised format and commanded that Mr. Chavez-Morales not illegally return to the United States.
Very briefly, Mr. Butcher mentioned the case of United States v. Zanghi. And in that case, the court said it's not appropriate simply to assume that the sentencing court's reason for opposing a prison term extends to the decision regarding supervised release. Maybe your answer to this question is going to be the same as the last one, but was there error in this case under Zanghi in the manner in which supervised release was imposed?
I see that my time is up. May I please answer your question?
If you would,
expeditiously.
Thanks.
In Zanghi, there is no record that I can see in the case itself about a dialogue between the defense attorney and the court about a term of supervised release. There is no request by the defendant to impose a term of supervised release as an alternative to more prison, as we see in Volume 3 of the record here on page 5. And there is no explanation by the district court, as we have in the paragraph in Volume 3 on page 16, about the explicit deterrent motive of the court in imposing the term of supervised release. So Zanghi is the law, But the United States takes the position that Chief Judge Johnson did not violate Zanghi in the way that he explained himself as shown in this particular record.
Thank you.
Thank you,
counsel.
Sir. And subject to any other questions, that's the time I have.
Thank you. Let's give Mr. Butcher one more minute over the...
May it please the court. As to Judge McKay's point, I think that's one of the pernicious things about what happened here. You know, we're not asking that there's some super high standard, but when the reason given before the court for the upper departure sort of doesn't make sense and is inconsistent with the mitigation factors that were argued, and the court doesn't address that, that's why I think in this particular case that it did not give meaningful consideration to the mitigation factors. If the court's real complaint was criminal history was insufficient, there is analysis that this court has approved and the Sentencing Commission has approved that the court could have engaged in. And that sort of seems where the court was going, but to say that there's this sort of fictional objective disrespect for the law is why I'm going to do an upward departure, I think did violate the rights and does require a remand. As to the supervised release issue, it's very important that courts state their reasons, especially when they give non-guideline sentence. As I mentioned in 3853, did not bring in 3553A2, but did bring in the requirement that there not be disparity between defendants. When the court, in this case, imposed a maximum term of supervised release that was not consistent with the guidelines, it does start risking a disparity, and without a reason given, this court has no reason ability to judge it. Reason is the soul of all law, but without reason, you have a soulless sentence that does affect the public's view of the integrity of the court and the integrity of the system. So in this particular case, and once again, I'd go back to Steele, as I think, just briefly, is I think that this is why it'd be helpful to have a rule requiring defense counsel or giving the defense counsel and the government an opportunity to comment on sentences once they are pronounced, which I think would have cleared up some of these issues here today. But once again, Your Honor, we ask that this court remand this case for new sentencing before the sentencing court. We believe both to give the court an opportunity to review the mitigation evidence and not base a sentence upon an improper factor, and to not argue or not impose a maximum term of supervised release in violation of 5D1.1, or if the court does, comply with 3553C and 3853A. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Case will be submitted. Counsel are excused. Thank you for your arguments.